So the first thing is that I'm not going to tell you how to avoid flu, except for telling you that it is established that the next influenza epidemics of this year will be dominated by a strain which is different from last year's and will be more severe. So if you can get vaccinated, it will help, because the last year's vaccine is nil for this year's influenza. But apart from, so this is just entering the topics of it. Why do we have to get vaccinated every year for influenza, whereas this is not the case for measles or for a number of other diseases? So let's first get a little bit of acquaintance with the virus of influenza. So this is one of the best cartoons I found. And influenza is a RNA virus. RNA is a single-stranded RNA, and RNA is prone just because it is single-stranded, so its genetic material is in only one copy. So it's prone to mutations. So the basic dynamics of this virus is that it has a very high mutation rate. We see that the genetic material, the genetic material of the virus is in inside a capsid inside the virion, and then there is a lipid envelope, and on this lipid envelope, from this lipid envelope, stick out some proteins. So there are two, the basic proteins on the attached to the envelope are hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. These proteins have an important role in the life cycle of the virus. And they are the ones which determine in great, percentage the immune response of the host to the infection. So this is a schematic of the life cycle of the virus. You have the viral particle, the virion, attaches to the cell, then enters the cell by endocytosis, fuses within the cell and sends the RNA into the nucleus, where the RNA is translated into proteins, and these proteins again assemble in the cytoplasm, and by budding are released. Usually the cell does not die, at least at the beginning of the cycle. If it does it too often, it will end up dying. But the reason to say, since the cell does not necessarily die during this cycle, this is why, in some sense, influenza is a minor disease. Let's look at the structure of hemagglutinin. So hemagglutinin is sticks into the lipid bilayer envelope of the virus and has some receptor sites, which are the ones which will connect to the cell membrane in the attachment phase. So on the other hand, it has a number of variable regions which are not extremely close to these receptor sites, which are the target of the immune response of the host. But they change, they are very prone to mutation, and they change quite fast in time. So, it is a common experience that, so let's first go to the basic facts so that you can get something about the terminology which is going on influenza. So there are three basic types of influenza, A, B, and C. The most relevant one from a medical point of view is A, which leads to these wide and severe pandemics from time to time, and they lead to, say, regular epidemics essentially every year, whereas B is more moderate and C is, say, medically much less important. So it is type, we are going to concentrate on type A, which is at the originates these global epidemics. And type A is, say, the influenza virus of type A can be classified according to the types of the two proteins that I have shown you before, so hemagglutinin and neuraminidase. Usually, so the classification is of the form H, some number, N, some number, according to the different types. So for instance, if we look now, we have a dominant subtype, it's called H3N2. So hemagglutinin type 3, neuraminidase type 2, and there is also subtype H1N1, which is an old subtype. In fact, it is the one which is was around in the 30s until the end of the 50s. And apparently, so it disappeared between the 50s and the late 70s, and then reappeared, and that somebody thinks that it has been probably a laboratory accident somewhere in Russia. Yeah, well, it's just a classification, basically historical. For instance, avian is H5N1, avian influenza. The one, say, the subtype which is more dangerous for now, is H5N1. And because H5 is different, then this does not yet go from human to human. Okay, but say, it's there's some, okay. Now, this is basically the puzzle is in this sort of is expressed by these sort of figures. This is a phylogenetic reconstructed tree. This is a gene tree for the HA, so the hemagglutinin subsequence of the virial genome, taken from samples you see from 1985 to 1996. It is a reconstructed and sort of, you know, that you can always try to arrange the leaves of these trees in the way that it's more suitable to your presentation. So it is arranged in some sort of chronological order of the time in which these subsequences have been isolated. And this is a very peculiar tree because you see that it has a very, so it, on the one hand, you find that there is a great deal of branching, but the branches do not live for a great deal of time. If you look at the lifetime of these branches, then you find that typically within 2 years or so, you have gone to a completely different subset. And at any given time, you don't find branches that, say, stick out of the backbone for more than a year or 2 years. I don't know what is the maximum that has been observed, but I know that the median is about 1.45 years. So it is a comb-like structure. What does it mean? It means that this... Okay, the tree that I've shown you is... I don't know, but say it's the order of 1,000 samples that have been sequenced. But there is a great deal of bias about how, when and how you choose the sample to be sequenced. So in fact, samples that are available have not been sequenced at that time. They might be resequenced now. And I have to explain to you, of course, the isolating the samples and then deciding when to sequence them is basically determined by medical reasons. And the medical reasons are when there is a strain which is likely to affect the human population because it is antigenically different from what it is current, then it was a sequence. Since the sequencing techniques have been developed in the late 90s to now, this selection has become weaker. But those data that I've shown you, they have only a subset of the sampled viruses have been sequenced. Okay, no. Yeah, you miss it. Yeah. Also, there is a problem with the geographic distribution. There is much more intense sampling in some areas than in others. Okay, so the point is that you can get some sort of regularity out of the analysis of the sequence, because in fact, in this paper, it was shown that it is possible empirically to identify 18 special codons of the HA subsequence, which are sort of diagnostic. The sequence which is closer to the backbone of the tree can be identified as being the one which has accumulated the largest number of non-silent mutations in these spatial codons. And it is conjectured that this is because they are related to the structure of these antigenic regions that I have shown you in the hemagglutinine protein. So this is, in a sense, empirical, but it works pretty well, although it's not been accepted as a criterion to identify the strain for, out of which you can make a vaccine. Now, the interesting point is that the tree does not branch out over long times. That's the point. So we have that, why does the dominant strain in influenza evolve fast and yet not diversify? So we have seen that structure of the tree. There are several viruses that have been sampled, and they show, if you look at comparable subsequent phylogeny trees, have a different topologies. This is a paper, influential paper by Grenfell and collaborators, in which they correlate somehow the structure of the tree with the epidemiological behavior of the virus. This is measles, and actually it's measles sampled from samples taken before the widespread vaccination policy in Britain from the 60s on. There has been a widespread vaccination policy, so the incidence, the prevalence of the disease has gone down. But before that, you have this structure of epidemics, which is pretty regular, and in fact, it can be quite well reconstructed from a very simple model of the kind that I'm going to discuss in the next slides. And if you look at this kind of trees that you can reconstruct out of the sequences, you find that this looks like just keeping on ramifying at more or less a regular reason along the time. So this is absolutely not like the one that we have seen. We have this dengue virus phylogeny, which I find very strange, and maybe one day or another I would like to understand it a bit more. There is a few big branches and then a lot of branches just very recently. This is a kind of HIV population phylogeny. So in this case, we have a high mutation rate, but then this high mutation rate leads to the coexistence of a great deal of long-lived branches, which settle in subpopulation or in single individuals and then keep on evolving. And this is the kind of structure that we are discussing for the influenza virus. So it is a comb-like. And this is the prevalence diagram for HIV in the early 90s, and this is the typical influenza diagram, prevalence diagram. You see there are very sharp peak of a small epidemics with a small duration, but a regular every year, but with varying intensity. Well, it looks, say, locally, it looks a little bit like that, in fact. Yeah, but the fact is that I don't know much about the time scale in which these things. So this is. But locally, it looks a little bit like that. Is that? I don't know. Okay, there is an interesting comparison that we can do, and it is a sort of the, say, the control case. Here we have again another representation of this influenza tree, and this tree here is in HIV within a single host. It's one of a number of cases that have been followed. And you see that this is time scale of about 2 years. So within this time scale, it seems that the dynamics of HIV, which has infected a single host and is kept by the host's immune system to a very low level of concentration, is evolving pretty much in the same way as the, say, global HIV system. So the explanation that one gets for this structure is that there is a sort of arms race between the virus and the host's immune system. So the virus tries to escape the host's immune system response by accumulating mutations in these relevant areas of its genome, and the host is adapting its response and try to keep it down. So this is the sort of verbal explanation that you can find in the literature. And the problem is whether this verbal explanation is enough to describe the data. Now we look at the epidemiological side of the problem. So in the usual viral affection with immunity is described by a classic model, which originates by Kermack and McKendrick with some modifications, in which you have you divide the population into their state with respect to the viral infection. So you have individuals are born, and when they are born, they are from immunological point of view, they are in a virgin state, so they are susceptible to the infection. When they get infected, so they can get infected, and of course they can get infected only if they get in contact with an individual which is infected. And then when they recover, they are no more able to get infected anymore, in a usual case, for example, in the case of measles. And of course, in any of these states, they are susceptible to die off, so that there is a finite lifespan for the individuals. You write down, out of this model, you can write down immediately very simple form of differential equations for the fraction of individuals which are in these states. So for instance, here you have the differential equation for the number of susceptible individuals. This is N, it's the total number of individuals in the population, times the birth rate. Then you have this red part here is probability of infection, which is gamma divided by N, times number of susceptibles, times the number of infected, and this is the death term. And you have a similar equation for the infected, so this is just this term here, but instead of being subtracted, you add it, because these are the new infected which arrive. And then there is a healing rate, rho, and the death rate, lambda, which reduces the number of infected. If you plug this in and you solve it for the behavior, you have find this typical behavior. You have a number of oscillations which die off and then go to a steady state. And this is just the number of infected goes to some steady state that can be characterized in terms of this death rate, so inverse lifetime, and healing rate, inverse of duration of the disease, and this infection rate gamma. And you can get something about also the behavior of the, say, the typical time scale of these oscillations, which will come back. And this related to the geometric ratio of the lifetime to the end, the disease duration. So for instance, for influenza, say that we are about lifetime about 50 years, and duration of the disease 1 week, you get that the typical time scale for this guy, for these oscillations, will be 1 year. Now, what happens if we have something like the influenza virus, in which you have a number of coexisting strains, because they have accumulated mutations, so there are different strains which have a different which elicit different responses from the individual, so that an individual can be susceptible to one strain and immune to a different one. So let's define a viral strain, identify a viral strain with some integer k, and write down equations for the number of infected individuals of that, individuals infected with that strain, and look, and of course the susceptible individuals to that strain, and you can write down some sort of equation, taking into account the fact that there is a probability that an individual which is immune with respect to a given strain will be also immune to with respect to a strain which is in some sense antigenically closed to the one you're looking at. So there is this cross-immunization. These people have considered what happens if you arrange the strains along a line and you start from giving, say, infection on the one end of the line and letting the virus change strain by mutations sequentially along the line. And what you get is something like a traveling wave, but with intrinsic oscillations on some scale, which is depends on the parameter, scale of the parameters you put in. So this is a typical diagram in which you have on the z-axis you have the incidence of the disease, so that is the number of individuals which have been affected by the disease with a given strain. This is the strain axis as a function of time, and you get these spontaneous oscillations with a constant rhythm. And again, if you look at the typical rhythm that you get is of the order of a year or so, if you plug in the numbers that you can get out. It is interesting that if you take a disease which lasts longer in the individual, you get a different pattern. This pattern, so here you have a disease which lasts a few years on the time scale of the individual. And in this case, you still have these oscillations, only that the incidence of the infection with a given strain does not die out afterwards. So you have a coexistence of different strains. And this resembles pretty much the pattern that we have seen for HIV infection in the population. On the other hand, so this is a very interesting result obtained from a very simple model. The difficulty with this model is that in some sense, so on the one hand it's very good, because if you plug in the numbers it corresponds pretty much to what people observe. But on the other hand, it's not so satisfactory, because a part of the answers are assumed rather than derived. So one is assuming that the strains can be arranged on one line and that the virus sequentially explores this one-dimensional space. And this is exactly assuming that the lack of this, in some sense, so you are saying that there is no reason for the diversification of the virus, because what you end up having is a wave of incidence of the disease. And of course, these waves leaves on the, on the left-hand side where it has passed, a population which is completely immunized against the disease. So what happens if you consider a wider topology? Now, it's very hard to generalize this system to a different topology. Well, because you have many strains, and then you need an exponentially number of states for the different susceptibility classes, and it's very hard to implement the finite population size constraint. So one turns to a different point of view. Let's make a model in which the unit is an individual, and an individual during his lifetime, her lifetime, is exposed to different strains and acquires different immunization states. And let's see what is the dynamics you can do that. Of course, this is more computationally intensive, but it can be done at least with moderate population size. So here I'm describing a work by these authors. It's a very simple model in which the model is that you are given, each individual has memory of all the strains it has been in contact with, and each strain is labeled by a binary string of some length. And then if it encounters, is exposed to an individual which is ill with a strain of the virus, compares the strains with all the ones which it has in its memory, and if it one of them is close enough, then it's immune. It's immune and the does not take the infection. So this is then the dynamics, and then of course all the rest. Say the illness lasts 1 week, and then it recovers, and so on. Now, if you do that, you find that typically you have these incidence curves. There is here, there is a dashed line. You see there is rise up and then it goes down. This is the global incidence for all strains of the disease. But you start in a virgin population or a population with some sort of, say, background immunity. You let a strain enter and you see what is the total amount of incidence in there. And you have also to take into account that the virus is mutating all the time with some rate. You change slightly the mutation rate, and you find this other curve. At the beginning, it looks pretty much the same. And in fact, if you look at it, the incidence is smaller than in the first case. And then it goes down, and then it goes up, and then finally you reach a situation in which the whole population is infected and remains infected after that. If you look carefully, you find that this is why, because the number of strains is so large that the individuals, whenever they end up being ill with a given strain, they immediately pick up a different strain and they go on in this way. So you have complete proliferation of strains, and the population is always ill. Say, each individual in the population is ill. In fact, you can write something like a phase diagram, say either the pathogen dies out or the pathogen persists, but it persists by infecting the totality of the population at all times. So this is very robust. You can finagle with the parameters and find that you have either extinction or boundless proliferation of your strains, and the 100% of the population is infected in steady state. Cross-immunization is not affected. But this is in some sense natural, because if you assume that there is no check, what we are describing is a sort of branching process in the space of strain. And so a given strain can either get extinct with some probability or can produce a different strain with some probability. And we know that the branching process has different behavior. Either it goes to extinction or it ends up by proliferating without limit. So there is no ways of checking the number of strains. This is what we expect to happen. So people have introduced another conjecture. So these guys, Ferguson, Giovanni, and Bush have conjectured the existence of a short-term immunity, which is strain transcending. That means that it affects all the susceptibility to all strains. And this is enough to get, say, a given individual past the epidemic season. So that, in fact, it is a way of saying that a given individual cannot get the disease more than once in a year, more or less. This is a conjecture containing a very complex model, and is a sort of, I would say, very scanty observational support. But let's see if it is sufficient by itself to explain the behavior. So this is what we did with Michael and two other collaborators some time ago. Just we took this idea and we tried to find whether in an individual-based model with the population connected without restriction to one another, we could sort of get a reasonable behavior. The only thing we also consider more is that each viral strain is characterized by a bare infectivity rate of beta K. So the bare means what would the infectivity rate that you would have if the virus were in a population of all susceptibles. So this is a basic parameter, basic infectivity parameter you're looking at. And we look after the number of individuals infected by given strain, effective number of strains, that is this expression here, and the total prevalence of the disease. This is what happens if you have only the short general immunity. This becomes just an ordinary SIR model of the kind that we have discussed before. We see the oscillations and then a level of disease which remains more or less constant, and this corresponds to what you get with the usual situations for the incidence. But if you look at the effective number of strains, you find that it is steadily increasing because of the accumulation of mutations. And this is obvious. In this case, all the mutations are neutral. There is no way to weed them out except when this is a larger population, except when you reach some sort of equilibrium between the mutations which enter and the what is called the genetic drift, which weeds them out. If we consider only random infectivity, but no short-term immunity, the behavior is like that. Say, either it gets extinct, the disease gets extinct, or you get a behavior which is pretty similar to what I have shown you of the bitstream model. And you see that again, we have all the individuals, basically here we have 500,000 individuals. And basically all the individuals get the disease, and the number of effective strains is increasing, although a little bit more slowly, because of this intrinsic selection between different strains. What happens if you have both mechanisms? If you have both mechanisms, this is what you see. Now, the incidence is here, this red line, and you find that we have a population of 500,000, and the incidence is a comparatively low level, 10,000, but with these typical peaks, only that these here, with these parameters, the peaks occur a little bit too often with respect to the dynamics of that. The green line is the effective number of strains. So you get that the effective number of strains gets systematically goes through bottlenecks because of this reduction of the incidence. And so it remains at a comparatively low level, 100, 150 strains. No, short immunity is general. And then there is a lifelong immunity against the particular one. Yeah. The number of infected is going up and down. Yeah. It goes up and down again, in fact. This is just a stretch. But this is... remains, it's not many strains, it's a reduced number, yes. But say the number of infected remains so small that in fact you keep having this. Yeah, but this is a, say, you can imagine that this is a finer population. You have a lot of drift. That, so the finer population is actually the population of ill people. And you have a drift. And this drift, this is a typical behavior of the number of different, types or genotypes in a population if you have a small amount of mutation. Yeah. No, it's shorter than that. Shorter than that. You see that this is in some sense a reduction of the SIR model to a smaller population, and there you have let's put it this way. The effective lifetime for this model is something that is of the order, but a bit longer, than the short-time immunity. Because that is the renewal time of the population itself. And you remember that the typical time scale for the oscillations was the geometric ratio of the illness duration and the lifetime. So this would be somewhere in between. Okay, so this is just to a little bit on the red line is the average infectivity, and you have this typical behavior. It starts getting very large, and then it settles somehow to an intermediate value. This blue line is the Hamming distance from the origin, which more or less increases, but with stepwise increases. And this is the number, typical diameter of the viral population, the number of mutations between, typical number of mutations between different strains which are in the population sampled corresponding to their frequency. And this remains pretty much the same. So what you should imagine is that you have a cloud of strains which evolves in this strain space and diffuses away from the origin. But keeping more or less with the same values of infectivity. So it's a sort of constrained walk only on those vertices in this space in which corresponds to that value of infectivity.
How does it depend on the size of the strain space?
On the size of the strain space, it doesn't depend much because it's really, they go on. The thing it depends mostly is something related to the mutation rate, and there is some sort of trade-off between mutation rate and the distribution of the bare infectivities. Also, you have to go beyond the threshold on the mutation rate for a given, in order to set into this regime. Otherwise, it ends in extinction. Okay, this is the kind of trees you get that looks, I would say that looks pretty much like the ones that I showed you at the beginning, but from time to time you have these flukes. So you have little bit of groups which are outlying groups, which are. Well, you see, if you forget about this group, then you'll find that there is a quite well-defined backbone that was short-lived with you. Yeah, okay. What I say is that this happens from time to time, and then you see that they're short-lived. Look at, say, the way in which here I sample everything. And the ones that you get out of, from the data, they are important, say, sampled according to the population, which is also quite large. Here sample all the cities. But okay, I agree that this is a problem. Okay, now, randomness of the infectivity parameter is difficult to check. It's not unreasonable, but the fact is that really the problem is that a short-term wide-range immunity has little evidence. There are a few very scanty. And there are some properties, for instance, the seasonality of the epidemiological dynamics, it cannot be reconstructed in this model. And also, they have been only a few clinical experiments, let's say, clinical case in which has been confirmed, but I haven't seen any, say, discussion of the possible origin of that. Of course, this would be a great importance, and the fact that nobody has rushed to, say, to find a mechanism for that makes me suspicious. But say there have been a few clinical studies, say looking at whether within this time span, people would be, say there was a definite serological reaction against different, completely wild, different mutants, different strains. Sorry, from since the. Say the numbers is on the 6 months range, something like that. It has to be long enough to get the people past the epidemiological season. So it is anything from say 4 months to 8 months would be enough. But that's it. You mean that there is an effect on the mutation rate? Well, but that in that case, you would probably see something corresponding to some sort of different rates in geographical differentiation, because you have this temporal behavior of the wave. That doesn't. But say mutation rates are sort of what difficult to get as such. I mean, what you get is a sampling, and then you see what is a sort of distribution of these samples. Yeah, it could be, say, that there is some part of the immune response, but in that case, it would be, why should it last only a few months? I mean, if you are able to elicit an immune response against one of the conserved proteins of the virus, then you should be immune forever. Yeah, okay, let's say, yeah. I know that, say, now, for instance, people are actively researching a way of getting immune response against some of the conserved proteins. Of course, it's much more important for HIV than for influenza, but I don't know how much this would be. Yeah. Okay. Say there can be some mechanism. The point is that after this proposal was made, then I was able to find a few clinical studies in which some sort of this short-term strain transcription response was supported, but I didn't find later a follow-up or looking at the molecular mechanism. So this is, I would say this is not my proposal. This was made first by Ferguson and Bush. So it's intriguing because, of course, if we were able to harness this this immunity, then we would solve the problem, epidemiological problem. So the proposal is that, in fact, we should look not at the sequence space, but at the antigenic space. And this is a first attempt by to give a structure to the space of the, say, the relevant space of the sequence evolution for the system. The idea is that here the analysis is still by looking at the genetic distance of sequences for the hemagglutinin subsequence. Actually, it's one of the subsequences, whatever. And by some sort of, say, cluster analysis, they were able to identify a typical scale in which these sequences could be clustered in a reasonable way and put them back into the sequence history of the prevalent strains. And what they found was this sort of behavior in which clusters would follow one another with a rhythm of, say, four or five years, typically. And this is, say, here you have, say, the total, say, the fraction of the cluster with respect to the total total number of samples. So what you have is that, in fact, it appears that you have a dynamics in which clusters are substituted one or another with a definite rhythm, and each of them remains prevalent, say, although the sequences are differentiated, then the clusters seems to be quite well defined during a time span which is much longer than the typical time span of epidemic sequence. Now, if you plug this time, lifetime of clusters into a SIR model, you find that you get an intrinsic time scale which is of the order of the year. And at this moment, if you just introduce a small perturbation which is periodic with this time scale, you find a very strong seasonality. So there is the conjecture that the seasonality, the very strong seasonality of the epidemiology of influenza, which is a puzzle in itself, can be due to the combination of this lifetime of the clusters and the usual SIR dynamics that I have described at the beginning. I have a problem with this approach because in SIR model, the lifetime of the individual, okay, you have a time scale which is a lifetime of the individuals. Well, the different life courses are not synchronized. Whereas if you have this cluster substitution dynamics, what it means is that every 4 or 5 years, you have basically a population which is totally susceptible to the new cluster coming in. So it is not exactly the same to introduce this time scale in SIR model and say that this explains the existence of this typical time scale of the order of 1 year. However, the idea of clusters has taken root, and there has been a more recent contribution by these authors in which they identify, say, they use antigenic clusters that are identified by looking at the ways in which different sequences are, say, in which different anti-sera respond to different sequences of hemagglutinin, and using that as a matrix, and then using some sort of cluster algorithms to put together sequences which elicit more or less the same antigenic response. And here you have again a tree in which the tree is again a phylogenetic tree of the HA1, say one subsequence of the hemagglutinin gene, again arranged according to time, but in which the colors correspond to different antigenic clusters which have been identified 3 years ago, 3-4 years ago, via the antigenic distance. And if you look now at the correlation, so this is the prevalence. Actually, no, this is the death rate. According to the death rate as a function of time, and these stars correspond to cluster transition from taken from that description I gave. Then you find that the highest peak correspond, by and large, to cluster transition. So that, in fact, that there is some sort of correlation. Whenever a new antigenic cluster comes in, then the severity of the disease is increased. This is not the prevalence. I would like to see the correlation with the prevalence. Okay, so this is a relation between, so these are the trees within, or the sequences within the clusters, and these gives you roughly the number of, say, the structure of these clusters and the number of mutations which are needed to go from one cluster to another. They go from three, which is, I think is here, no, here there is even one, and here there is the largest one is 16. So this suggests... No, okay, that's a say. Well, I will use that in a moment. I will use that in a moment to show you the geometry that you have to imagine, by which you have to imagine this cluster. Because that's one of the things that are not very intuitive. We are accustomed to see clusters as something like potatoes. But they are not potatoes, they are networks. And in fact, these clusters intertwine in genetic space. Okay, so what these Curl and collaborators did was starting a simulation of an individual-based model in which this cluster structure was a sort of written in, say, by called the spin-glass model or genotype-phenotype mapping. So it was a way of mapping sequences into cluster, which was sort of in which the parameters were regulated somehow. And the kind, so you have here you have the prevalence of the disease, and the interesting thing is here you'll get the diameter of the viral population as a function of time. And the typical and the colors correspond to the different clusters. So what you have is that typically you have the diameter of the viral population increases when it is lies within a cluster, then it suddenly drops down. It invades a new cluster and then goes up again, and then goes down and then goes up again, and so on. This corresponds, you see that every time that you go to a new cluster, you find a higher prevalence, which corresponds to these peaks. So this suggests a kind of dynamics which Sam Nienwegen has said influences escapes immunity along neutral networks. So the idea is that here we have a representation of the clusters in this high dimensional sequence space, and the clusters are not compact. They are, in fact, sort of networks which are ramified, and they penetrate one another. So there are places in which you have a short connection between one cluster and another. At the beginning, you have that all the, say, the viral population has colonized one cluster, but then evolves more or less neutrally along this thing. And within one cluster, the population is gets its immunity against basically all the viral sequences which belong to one cluster. Then at a certain point, there is a founder population that jumps into a different cluster and finds that the population is no more immune, and therefore there is a great advantage for the viral, for the virus to colonize this new cluster, and the very rapidly, so there is a selective sweep, very rapidly the population, the viral population will occupy these new clusters and then differentiate in sequences. And the process goes on in the same way, so in this way. Now, this is very nice. It's a very nice idea, but I wonder if that is sufficient to solve a problem, because from on the face of it is just that instead of looking at the sequences, now you're looking at the antigenic space, and the effective mutation rate in antigenic space is some mutation rate. Yeah. Well, the clusters are, I would say, are the subspace of the sequence space of the virus, which correspond to a given antigenic response. Okay? So the idea is that from the point of view of your immune system, all sequences which belong to a given cluster are equivalent. Well, okay, they say the immune systems of the human population. Yeah, okay, there is...
The same antigen people will develop immunity
to different parts of the Yeah, but say... okay, so what you say is that there is an intrinsic variability of the immune system response. Okay, and this is, yeah, okay, this is not assuming that this does not happen. This is a sort of a simplified model in which you assume that given a sequence, then you have a given immune response, and that's it. Of course. So that's a big problem, but it's not considering this yet. Now, say, but what is that in this case, what you... if we simply describe the same process, not anymore at the level of sequences, but at the level of antigenic space, then we are back to square one. We have exactly the same problem as with the BIS-Link model that we started from. It's only that instead of having the mutation rate per base, we have something like an effective mutation rate in antigenic space. But then the result is the same. So the most more recent proposal that I have seen is this contained in this paper, is that in fact the antigenic space itself is not a very wide, high-dimensional space, but is a really a low-dimensional space. And in fact, the proposal is that it is as low as a two-dimensional space, and that there is a, something like a full house effect that at any given time, the prevalent strain is not the strain which has picked up the best of in this Garden of Eden of all possible variants, but has picked up the least bad variant against which, say, the response of the population is least likely to act. And the kind of, argument that is behind this proposal is a principal factor mapping of antigenic response over different clusters that I have described before. This is taken from the original, say, Smith and Hall paper, which suggested what was the antigenic space structure of these hemagglutinin sequences. Saying that you and looking at what happens as a function of time, and what you find is that you can have this plot in which you have one principal axis here and the second principal axis there, and you find that the in time the virus is doing some sort of zigzag in the second principal axis direction and moving more or less steadily in the first one. So so that in fact it is the second principal axis which is sort of characterizing the antigenic response. And on the left here we have a simulation data of a model in which there is some introduction or some sort of a finite panoply, finite number of possibilities for these antigenic epitopes, and with a model of the immune response against this finite number of possibilities, and you get that there is the evolution you get looks more or less similar in shape to this one. Here I would really like to understand better what you can say out of that, of say how you classify the antigenic response and whether there is a correlation between the sequence data and antigenic clusters in a reasonable quantitative way. And I hope that we'll hear more of that later in this program. So, So I think that what we is that the antigenic space is surely more complex than we have suspected. It cannot be, say, simply described by some sequence space in which the relevant distance is something like the Hamming distance or so on. Nevertheless, I wouldn't say that the lack of diversification is directly explained by this cluster approach, because of that, I can reduce the description to this antigenic space, and I am back to the problem that I had with the bitstream model. I also already mentioned that the antigenic transition is not equivalent to shorter host lifetime, so that the proposal that this at least explains the seasonality, I don't think it holds water. And one point is that these models anyway do not take into account recombination, which is known to take place during epidemics. But this is probably not so relevant if you're looking really at these small, short sequences, because they are all sitting in one chromosome of the virus. So I would say we can conclude that in any reasonable explanation of the behavior of influenza, we'll have to combine the epidemiological and the evolutionary level. And I say that we have seen that there is probably an idea that it will possible to also understand something about the behavior of HIV infection if we understand the puzzle influenza, but we have still quite a long way to go. And I would like to thank, well, Walter Fitch introduced me to this problem, and Michael Lessig, with whom I have collaborated and discussed for a long time, and I will see Franz and Francesca Pria for collaboration. And all of you for your attention. Is comparatively minor with respect, say, for instance, to HIV. The reason is that we usually don't die of influenza. And the reason for that is that usually the virus does not die directly the cell. That's the only thing, all I said. Well, I don't know why it doesn't, but probably simply it doesn't divert too much of the material produced by the cell nucleus to kill the cell. I don't know much about the Well, the epidemiological equations usually are on the mean field because one assumes that one is describing a large population, and in the case of influenza, this is quite okay. you might have to look at, say, a master equation approach. If you're considering a geographic spread, in that case, you have to, you go to the level of looking at sparse population, and in that case. Okay, I don't know much about dengue, and that's really a puzzle, but take measles. In measles, what you have is that once you get measles once, you don't get it anymore, okay? So that means that whatever variation there is in the virus is not immunologically relevant. So what you expect is a neutral tree. In the case of influenza, you have that there is a strong selection for innovation, at least at the level of a hemagglutinin sequence. And therefore, in fact, you have an enhancement of the mutation rate at the level of these immunologically relevant sequences with respect to background. So you know that the virus is selecting for the accumulation of variations in that area. And the puzzle is, why doesn't it diversify? It will be so easy to have two or three or several subtypes coexisting and infecting the population. It doesn't do it. Well, yeah, okay. No, okay, let's say everybody thinks that there is something like a 10% or 20% modulation of the basic infection rate along the year. Okay, so this, but why does it lead to this extreme seasonality, which is, yeah, there is something that is it's not understood. Well, I don't know whether, yeah, temperature could play a role. This is not ruled out. Say, the common, the folklore says that it's much more than the temperature, the fact that people tend to live in the same, same rooms, and yeah, and the air, and that's it. But say, temperature would, sure, some sort of role. Well, imagine that this short-term pan, let's say, strain-presenting immunity exists, then it should be comparatively easy to find a way to elicit by some sort of directed vaccine, understanding what is the target of that, and then you would vaccine exactly, you would make a vaccine which has, yeah, a good target. For instance, I mean, you have a question? If not, let's thank the speaker again.